It is August 9th, 2018. This is Anjali Grantham, and I am in Deming, Washington with Janet and Harvey Henry, and we're going to be speaking about can rework this afternoon. Harvey, could you begin by talking about when and where you were born and what early experiences led you to become a can reworker?
Well, I was born in Bellingham, my parents, I'm not sure how they made acquaintance to Bob and Betty Gorton, but my dad and Bob Gorton were friends. I think it was just a neighborly acquaintance. I think they both were neighbors in Laconia right after my parents were first married. Bob Gorton was established in the cannery business even at that time, and he approached my dad on numerous occasions. It was my dad, being a competent auto mechanic, Bob being his friend, thought he could take him north and transition him into maybe a port engineer position, which he eventually did the year that I turned 18. And probably the only reason that my dad did go ahead and take Bob up on that offer was to sort of segue me into being able to work in a cannery if I wanted to, because the agreement was, when he agreed to go up and work for Bob, was that I would go up as a machinist apprentice at the cannery. My dad hated it, and he never went back again until probably around 1990 or 91, when we talked him into coming up to South Naknek for a season, and he hated it again. So that was 1976 that my dad and I went to work for, at that time, was it, boy, I think it was still Alaska Packers. I can't, it may have been Kodiak. But it was being operated cooperatively with Alaska Packers at that time still.
And that was the Larson Bay Cannery?
That was the Larson Bay Cannery. So my dad worked as a port engineer there that 1976 salmon canning season, and I worked as a machinist apprentice, both in the fish house and in the main cannery. So I helped the chink man, the iron chink man. That was what that title position was for the fish house. That was the machinist position title. And then I also helped the filler man and the seamer man in the cannery during that season. I think I also helped somebody from Seattle Boiler Works and the boiler man retube one of the boilers that season. So, as I said, that was my dad's last season, but I went back for the return season in 1977, and by 1977, my memory's a little goofy here. Okay, so I went back there in 1977, but at that time Dexter and Van Johnson had already taken over the management duties there at Larson Bay. Actually, I don't know that Dexter I don't think Dexter had any kind of management position at that time, but Pete Marinkovich would have been an old Alaska Packers guy and superintendent at that time. That was, I think, he was the superintendent of the plant there, and then, of course, Van Johnson. In 1978, then, Bob Gorton talked me into going down to Excursion Inlet, where I spent two six and a half, seven-month seasons canning salmon Excursion Inlet. To return back to Larson Bay in 1980, again with Van and Dexter. That's when Janet, my wife Janet, that's where we met, was there, and she can expand on it a little bit, but she was Van's mother's hairdresser, and that's how she knew the job was available. In that, I think in that year in Larson Bay, I don't really remember what my job title was in Larson Bay that year, but I did a lot of welding there that year. A lot of boat work, and cannery stuff. Anyway, in the winter of 1980, Jim Johnson. Jim Johnson was working for, I think, still Alaska Packers at the Semiahmoo Spit during the winters, doing machinery overhauls and boat and tender overhauls. And Jim employed me the winter of 1980-81 there at the Semiahmoo Spit Plain, where we, I think we rebuilt some seamers and some fillers and whatnot. And subsequently, Jim was the foreman at Alaska Packers South Naknek. So I went to work for him after that winter season of overhauls in Blaine, and worked for Jim at South Naknek first as a can shop man. First season, not a can shop man. That would have been Mick and Tom Connolly. So first season. First season, maybe I was there, seamer man. I think a seamer man there for, which is a machinist position, a specialist position, in the actual canning. Actually, another name for the seamer would be the closing machine, the closer, whatever. So, that 1981 season, then I would have worked as a seamer man there to move up into the can shop the following year, 1982. The can shop in 1982, you spoke about the line shop. The can shop in 1982 in South Naknek was all still completely line shaft driven.
Could you describe that system?
Well, typically the lines would all, you know, you had five pieces of machinery in each can making line, and the cans came up in three pieces, but the cans came up as a flat piece of tin that was either soldered or in later years welded together, originally soldered, and then probably in the mid-1980s they started welding them together instead of soldering. But it was flat, and so you had a couple of, so you stacked the cans in a hopper, and they were a flat piece. They were just like if you took the lid off of a can on both ends and you smashed it flat. So you had an operator on each machine, and the operator would load this hopper with these flattened cans, and you had a machine that was named a reformer. In our case, we had American Can manufactured reformers. Continental Can also had a reformer. It was actually quite innovative, and I ran one of those for a time in Uganic Bay, but we didn't have their style machinery at South Naknek. But the reformer, basically a slide, pushed that onto a horn and spun and made that into a cylinder, made that flat can into a cylinder, where it was transferred through a conveyor system to another machine that put a flange on each end of that can. And from there, it was transferred to a closer, a seamer. And the seamer would load a lid onto it and then basically put a curl over that flange to create a seal, a hermetical seal, on the can. And then it went into a conveyor system that delivered it by gravity feed to the cannery itself downstairs as an open container ready to be loaded with fish. So each of these lines in the can shop, in our case, had, because it was an American Can style, that the Continental line would be a little bit different dynamic, but the American Can style, as I recall it, had two reformers, one flanger, and two seamers in each line, so a total of five machines. The way that, and elevators to deliver that up and then allow gravity to deliver it back down to the next machine in the process. The elevators and the five machines were all, in each line, were all driven by one central electric motor in this case. That electric motor would power a series of pulleys that transferred that electric motor's power through a big flat belt, generally three, four inches, even 5 inches wide, depending on how big the machine was, what the load was, and transferred that power from that central motor to each machine. So one motor basically ran the whole line through a transmission of belts. It also operated the elevators. And the elevators were also quite innovative in that they had this mercury switch system that would load up with the weight of the cans, and then when it had enough, it would trip the mercury switch, and that would deliver power to a magnet, a magnetic clutch that would close and allow new cans to be delivered over it. So the whole thing, though, ran off of this one central motor.
Was it someone's job to care for that?
Well, that was part of my job, was to care for that. Yeah. So basically, in each department, there would be a head machinist and then typically an apprentice or a helper or both. And so, really, in the fish house, for example, that specialist machinist's title would be the chink man, the iron chink man or the chink man. And his duties would be to keep that machinery carry the iron chinks themselves in good running condition, and also to adjust them to make them clean fish as efficiently as possible. So obviously, cannery bought fish, we want to put as much good fish in the can as we can. We don't want to send a bunch of it out the gurry flume, so that chink man's job is to keep those operating as efficiently as possible and recover as much fish from each cleaning as possible. But to expand on that, his job would also be to see to it that all the conveyor belts were in running order, and that the motors and the guards and the gurry flumes and the pumps and everything else that was encompassed in that fish house was in running order. That would be the same case in that can shop, in that all of those transfer elevators, all of that can making machinery, etc., would be taken care of by the can shop man, basically.
You said that, so the five pieces of machinery is the hopper, reformer, flanger, sealer.
Well, there were more than five pieces of machinery, but there were five pieces of primary machinery of so there were two reformers, one flanger, and two seamers.
Okay.
The rest of the machinery would be for the transmission of cans from point A to point B. So there we would have elevators and gravity chutes. And then after the process, there was a long cable runway that the seamers delivered to the can, that can runway, and then the runway would probably at any given time be each runway, depending on the number of lines you're running. Sometimes you're running three, even four lines, depending on how big your crew was and what your demands were. Each of those runways at any given time might have a couple thousand cans in them, which kind of helped create a little bit of a buffer in the event that you had a momentary shutdown. The cannery could keep running, and you had that little buffer of extra cans while you got it rolling again. So the that can runway was also part of the can shop man's responsibility to make sure it operated properly and didn't jam up or whatever the case. So as I said, that I think the season of 1981 and 1982, I was that. Let's see. Yeah. So we went back there in 1980. I was the seamer man, and then in 1981 and 82, I was probably their can shop man. But geez, it's been a long time ago, so I don't remember how the transitions when they were.
So when you say that you're the seamer man, your responsibility was to make sure the seamer was properly running all the time, or was it more?
Yeah, well, there's more to it than that, because the seamer is one of the more complex machines in the cannery, in that that hermetic seal has got. We spoke earlier. You said, was that during the botulism crisis? Well, actually, the botulism crisis, now that I think about it, was back in the 70s. That there's very narrow parameters in that seam about whether or not it will create a proper hermetic seal or not. So everything in that machine has got to be adjusted within a few thousandths of an inch to consistently close that can without any danger of a breach of that hermetic seal.
Mm-hmm. How would you test the cans?
Well, of course, the seamer man has a responsibility to cut a certain number of cans open every couple hours cut the seam open, measure a cross section of the seam, measure a cross section of the can. So, I mean, I've still got tools out there in the garage. If we had a can, I could show you. I could show you the external. I could probably show you all the measurements, actually. So you have external measurements across the top of the seam, and then you also have external measurements across the width of the seam. Obviously, there's only so much material in that lid. So if you have too much material in the width of that seam or the depth of that seam externally, that must mean you're missing some material on the inside. So you can tell a lot just by the width and the depth. Also, if anything's out of adjustment inside of there, if you're if your chucks or your rolls are not properly lined up in there, you can, even though your measurements are right, you can squeeze a sharpness into that can that can actually create a leak. And then, of course, as I said, ultimately you end up cutting the can apart, tearing the seam apart, and measuring the inside of it. So the seamer man does that, and if anything's not in the right parameters as far as the seam's measurements go, you're going to have to shut down, and you're going to have to adjust it. You may have to replace parts. Parts wear out. Obviously, literally millions of cans going through there, so parts wear out. Since millions of cans are going through there, it's not a perfect process. Some of them get caught, some of them get jammed up, sometimes you open the door and there's salmon all over everything, and there's tin all over everything, and there's cans jammed everywhere, and you're in there with hooks, and you're pushing and shoving and pulling, and eventually you yard all of that stuff out of there. And sometimes you even have to take part of the machine apart to get the stuff out of there. And sometimes a wreck like that will bend parts. So you're always checking immediately after a major jam like that to make sure that your seam is still in parameters. If it's not, then you're going to shut down. You're going to try to figure out what's going on? What's been? What is now out of adjustment because of the wreck? Maybe there's even still some tin caught in there that's causing the problem. But whatever the case, that's another part of the seamer man's responsibilities. Along with that, every cannery employs a competent quality control crew is also going to be following up on those same seams. They're going to be doing the same tear downs. They're sort of going to be a third party to keep that seamer man accountable to a quality closing, a safe, hermetically sealed can, basically. They're going to check vacuum on the can, make sure that your seamer's drawn the right vacuum. All those things are taking place. Those are kind of the seamer man's primary responsibility. With an American can piece of equipment, there was another really antiquated piece of equipment that had kind of been tried to keep up with the process, called a clincher, that kind of set that lid on the can before it went to that seamer. That was a really problematic piece of machinery, but it was also fell within kind of the seamer man's responsibility to make sure that was operating properly and wasn't getting jammed up and wasn't causing its own defects to the can. Along with that, if everything is working great for the seamer man, he's got a companion up there on the other end of the line, a filler man who's responsible to make that machine put a good-looking package of fish in each can and get it the right weight, and just like that chink man, make sure that he's not putting too much or too little in there, because, you know, we don't want to make a 1 pound can with 1 pound and 1/10 of an ounce more, because that adds up at the end of the day. So all of that stuff, you know, we need recovery there too. And so at any given time that filler man might be having a problem and that seamer man isn't, he will probably transition himself up there and try to help the guy out, as that filler man probably will do for that seamer man.
So the filler is where the fish house...
So the fish house is going to deliver fish to, from, once it leaves that iron chink, it's going to be delivered to what's called a sliming table, which is really just sort of a quality control table where a group of employees will review each fish and see to it that that iron chink didn't miss a fin, didn't miss a belly fin, didn't miss a gill plate, didn't miss some guts, whatever, so that that's a clean, efficiently cleaned fish, still maintaining as much weight as possible, and will be generally delivered once it leaves that fish house by a conveyor belt. And in the case of Naknek, that was a really long conveyor belt because the fish house was quite a distance away from the cannery itself. And so the fish would be transferred from that conveyor belt to a hopper, a bin, whatever you want to call it, that sat immediately away from the filler with a chute. And cannery workers that loaded the filler would generally hit either a mechanical or a pneumatic, an air-operated style door that would open up and allow a few fish to flow out onto a table, and then they would load them onto this filler. They would go into the filler and be transferred, chopped up, and transferred into a can. And that would be the filler man's job, would be to maintain and adjust that piece of machinery so that it did it right. Got that can of salmon looking pretty at the right weight, the whole deal. Now, it's been too many years, so I've forgotten at what point. I don't know if the can shop, because in 1984 I went to Euganic Bay, and when I came back to South Naknek, I think I worked as a first machinist. And a first machinist is kind of a move from all about the cannery. Oversee the can shop man's process, and the filler man's process, and the chink man's process, and maybe even be there in the event that they're sick for a day in their place. But also, you know, help them if they have a question with their issues, or just be there as a second set of hands. So, again, I kind of forget when that took place, but the reason I bring it up is because that can shop position more or less ended somewhere in the mid-80s when the can manufacturing process changed to what we called a nesting can. So the cans were no longer sent up in basically three pieces, a top lid, a bottom lid, and a flat. They were now a formed can. They were formed down here in typically down in Tukwila, most of them. Most of the cans that went to Alaska, I believe, were formed in Tukwila. And I actually worked briefly in Tukwila for Continental Can, or with Continental Can. I was actually working for Kodiak Alaskan Seafoods, but I worked for them at Continental Can in Tukwila on Continental Seamers. But where I was doing that was in a plant that manufactured tapered cans. And the tapered can allowed them to now efficiently ship an already formed can body up there, because the tapered can worked like a Dixie cup. They all nested together. So that eliminated the necessity for those two reformers, that flanger, and those two seamers. Those machines went away and never came back again. And what was put in its place was nothing more than a little machine that separated the Dixie cups, so to speak, separated the nested cans, and delivered them to that conveyor, that can way.
What so was that machine called?
I think we called it a denester. I think that machine's called a denester, as I recall it. And you know, it was such a simple piece of machinery that really it rarely needed to be worked on, and it kind of was one of those things where if it did, it was kind of just it kind of fell to typically probably the first machinist or the shop machinist, whoever was kind of free at the time, because you just didn't need a can shop man anymore. So what you ended up with was a can shop with probably only about a total of maybe six people and a can shop boss, basically.
And before, how many were there?
Well, there would have been, there might not have been a whole lot more employees up there. There would have been a shop machinist, can shop machinist, a helper or apprentice, a person for each reformer. So if you were running four lines, there would have been eight people just for the reformers. And then I believe you had to have a person. The seamers ran slow enough downstairs that you could utilize one person to feed two seamers, feed lids. So you needed somebody to feed lids on that. So you would have had, if you were running all four lines at a time, you would have eight people at reformers and four people at seamers. So you would have 12 people. Generally, you had somebody on the conveyor line, 13, plus your machine is 14, 15. You had a minimum of 15 people in there if you were running four lines, which you usually didn't do. Usually you only ran two to three lines, but there were seasons when we did run four lines.
Was also before the sanitary can came around. Do you think that that's where the cans were made at the turn of the 20th century?
Well, at the turn of the century, the cans were there was no can shop. They were soldered together. So I don't remember now whether they would have been shipped up as a flat like that and reformed, but the lids were soldered on at that time. So, so you didn't really have a can shop same realm, because he didn't. There was no seaming process, so he wouldn't have had a seamer either. And even the filler, the original fillers were quite a bit simpler piece of machinery. In fact, the Continental filler was quite a bit simpler piece of machinery than the American can one, but it worked pretty well, but it was quite a bit simpler piece of machinery.
I'm just thinking if they use the same space as the process changed over time and as machines were added and then taken away, if it always happened.
That's a good question. I mean, actually, the warehousing areas were a lot bigger than our needs by then. So it would suggest that maybe in earlier years, they had to have a huge crew there to be making those cans. Yeah. Most of the area that the can shop operated at in Naknek was used as net locker. The vast majority of that building was used as a net locker, that entire upstairs floor, except for maybe the last, I don't know, one third of the building at the most was utilized for a can shop. The rest of it was all web locker. But it could have been that at the turn of the century, that was all utilized for all the people that took solder all those cans together. I really don't know the answer to that question. So, but yeah, they weren't originally. They weren't done that way.
Who made the denester? Was that an American can or a Continental or some other? Do you remember?
Golly, I don't remember. I got a hunch they probably both made them, and I think the nested can, I think that American Can may have been producing the nested can in California, and Continental Can was producing them in Tequila, if I remember right. So I guess that part of it depended on, I mean, it didn't really matter which, the cans were identical, even though the machinery is different, the process is the same, so it didn't really matter whether you're running a Continental nested can in an American can machine or vice versa. Yeah. Anyway, I guess at Euganic Bay in 1984, we went to a Euganic Bay. The one season I worked there, shop machinist or filler man, I can't even remember. Filler man, I think. No, I was a seamer man. I was a seamer man at Euganic Bay. Again, I was a filler man. Excursion Inlet for a season or two seasons, I guess. But it would have been a seamer man, because that's why I was in Tequila, was to familiarize myself with the Continental seamer being considerably different than the American can seamer, and being the equipment of choice there in Euganic Bay. That's what they had there.
And what was the difference?
Well, you know, the outcome was the same. It was just the process to get there was different. The Continental seamer was simpler. It was a simpler piece of machinery in a lot of ways, and I guess it also kind of eliminated the need for that clincher, as I recall. But I mean, the underlying difference was it was a machine made by a different manufacturer, really. It did the same thing. It put a seam on a can, hermetically sealed a can. Yeah. If there was the filler, the Continental filler was a ton simpler, probably not quite as efficient, but easier to work on, easier to work with. The Continental reformer was an amazing piece of equipment. And it's too hard to describe. I would actually have to show you. I'd have to show you, Google a picture of it or something, and show you the differences. But it was a remarkable piece of equipment in that the way the can was fed onto it and reformed, and it had a single long horn on it that was flat on the end that flat can was sent down to, and then it graduated up to a round solid piece of steel as you got further and further along. And the can was pushed along that, and that horn sort of floated in space, so to speak, and that it had this elaborate camshaft setup that allowed that horn to be suspended on four points at any given time that were in constant motion, so they would get out of the way of that can as it moved along that horn. And really all of that equipment, whether it was Continental can equipment or American can equipment, was just really full of ingenious, innovative mechanical marvels. They really were. They were huge pieces of cast iron and steel. 10,000-pound pieces of equipment that were really remarkably complex. Mm-hmm.
And were they all quite old when you were working on them?
Well, the iron chink G's that I ran down at Excursion Inlet, those probably dated back to the 19-teens. In 1920s, and then the American can fillers and seamers, those were probably in the 30s and 40s that most of that equipment was developed, I'm sure a lot of that equipment is still being operated today, though I've not been in the cannery for quite a few years. And I have no doubt that in a number of foreign countries, South American countries, etc., that equipment is being used today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that fish house machinist, that iron chink man, his duties kind of started to just about where that elevator started lifting fish out of the tender until they left that fish house. So that would be one machinist's position, and then where those fish were delivered, that would be the filler man and the seamer man, and that being kind of maybe the most complex area of the process, typically that's where the first machinist would hang out as well. Not just to make sure all that stuff was working, but there's a lot of equipment happening in there, and those two guys and a couple helpers, they really needed that first machinist in there to be covering those bases and seeing to the other seamer or whatever, because if one seamer was down and that seamer man was trying to make that that thing make quality seams again, that first machinist might be called upon to do it on the other seamer. Or maybe everything's running good on that end, but that filler man's having a real problem, but there's another filler having a problem. That first machinist is going to have to be accommodate that need, or the weighing machines or anything along the process. So, you know, the first machinist was somebody that needed to be able to kind of have pretty good working knowledge of all the equipment in the cannery. So, I mean, the cannery might be running beautiful and smooth, but all of a sudden the chink man's over his head in alligators. So that first machinist, he may spin out there for a little while and do that. So you had the iron chink man out there and a helper. You had a seamer man, a filler man, a helper, in some cases more than one helper, and a first machinist, typically in the cannery where the fish was actually being delivered to the can and hermetically sealed in the can. Once it left the cannery, then you have what was called a salmon cook or a bull cook. And his responsibility would be to basically monitor the cook with a and the crew that did the cook. So he kind of, even though he was a machinist, he kind of had to operate as a little bit of a boss over the folks that were stacking all the retort trays. And the cans would be delivered right out of that cannery down a little conveyor way, where they would kind of fall out into a spill chute, and that spill chute would deliver them into a tray. And you'd have a couple of folks working each of those trays on each line. They'd have a stick on either end, and they would allow the cans to come in, line up on the stick, and then they'd layer it out, and they'd layer that thing until that tray was full, and then they would transfer that to a car, and when those rail cars had the right number of stacks on them, they'd load into the long retort, the big cook tube, doors closed. The retort man, the bull cook, the salmon cook, had to. I'm making a mistake. I don't think bull cook is the proper term for that. Salmon cook was it. Bull cook's a different job. And salmon cook, had a clock that was attached to each one of those retorts. Literally got feedback from the steam, the whole deal. So the time and the temperature were recorded perfectly when the cook came up and when the cook came down. Anything more, anything less, and you didn't have a safe product. So that was basically the salmon cook's position. Of course, in order to cook that salmon, you need to deliver steam to those retorts. So you also have to have a boiler man. You have to have somebody responsible to see to it that those boilers are up and running first thing in the morning. You have steam on board, not just for the retorts, but typically most canneries, and Naknek was among them, during the salmon canning season itself, would utilize steam for the kitchens and sometimes for other needs around the cannery. So you had some canneries heated with steam in certain areas. They cooked with steam one way or the other. In Naknek, our coffee pots were heated with steam. So you literally use steam to heat coffee water. So there you had a salmon cook and a boiler man. So there's two more machinists there. Then you had was there a bright stack? I don't think there was an actual machinist position titled for the bright stack. The bright stack was a relatively simple piece of equipment, but one of us, typically a first machinist, shop machinist or somebody always would get to get the nod when something was wrong with it.
And what did that machine do?
Well, after the salmon was cooked, then it needed to be what we call palletized. So the trays that they were put in the retort in were considerably smaller than what you would stack them, the way that you would stack cans for transport to the marketplace. So what the bright stacks process was once the cans were cooked and cooled, and they have to be cooled. There's no handling cans until cans are cool. It's not safe to handle cans until they're cool, really, because you know you could have vacuum draw something, although it's not. It shouldn't be. If everything's sealed up, it shouldn't happen. But you really should avoid handling cans a lot till they've at least started cool. If you're ever out there, once they're all cooked, you'll hear the cans the whole time. Pop, 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 pop. All the vacuum of the cans is equalizing after the cook. So once they were transferred by rail car, manually delivered by rail car, to the bright stack machine, they would be tipped upside down so that those cans were all delivered onto a big wide belt that indexed them to the size that they would ultimately be when they were palletized. I don't remember exactly the dimensions, but think of a pallet being like 42 by 48, something like that. So they would be indexed into like a 42 by 48 inch platform, and an electric magnet would come down, pick them up, scoot them over to a pallet board, set them down on the pallet board. The magnet would release, allow all the cans to stay in that indexed fashion on that pallet board, return back to the belt, pick up another stack of them, and set those on top of the first layer of cans until you had a full layer of cans, at which point they would either be covered with cardboard in some cases, or in most cases wrapped with a shrink wrap. Ultimately to be stacked upon top of each other and transferred into container vans to be shipped to the marketplace.
And so you called that the bright stack?
That would be called the palletizer or the bright stack. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was the retort at Naknek or other canneries that you worked at, did it have two doors, one at each end?
Yes.
It's
my understanding that there were vertical retorts, but I don't remember. I may have seen vertical retorts somewhere, but I don't remember ever operating in a cannery where there were vertical retorts, where the cans were literally sort of dumped in. In the case of Naknek and all the canneries that I was at, the retorts were basically a huge pipe that was oriented horizontally, and they were probably 100 feet long or more, with a door on either end. Loaded on the cannery end and unloaded on the bright stacker end. Mm-hmm.
And how many retorts?
Varies from cannery to cannery. At South Naknek, it seems to me like there were either 9 or 10 retorts,
and
as I recall.
Would they all be cooking at the same time?
No, because you would never. At the end of the day, you may end up at times where all the the operational retorts might be all cooking at the same time briefly, but remember, they didn't all fill up at the same time, so they're not all going to unload at the same time. Cook time was roughly an hour and a half, so by the time you got the one, by the time you got the one on that end full, that one was ready to be empty, or vice versa. So, okay. Yeah, it was so pretty unusual to have all the retorts going at the same time.
And so there'd be a one rail car for the loading and one rail car for unloading.
Yeah, well, there was rails that went into each retort.
Okay.
So then you would have another rail that would intersect, or whatever the case might be, mm-hmm. so that you could transfer them to ultimately the bright stack. But at the end of each canning line, you would have a rail, and then you would have an intermediate rail so that you could transfer from retort to retort. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you'd have an intersection of rails. I need to watch my videotapes so I can jog my own memory, because I haven't been in a cannery since 1994, and that's a while. Yeah.
And so
95.
That's
still a while.
That is a while. And so that's the end of the purview of the machinist once the...
Well, you still have other machinists, because there's a machinist that is responsible for generation of electricity. So every cannery is different. Naknek had, I think, either two or three main generator sets, and then maybe two lesser generator sets that would be backup or pre-season generators when we didn't need as much power. And in Naknek, unlike a lot of places, you could also operate off of the public power grid. In Larsen Bay, you didn't have you probably do now, but at that time, in 1976, you didn't have a public power grid, and same goes for Excursion Linlet. There was no public power grid. You didn't even have phones, right? If you want to call out, you use ship-to-shore radios.
Yeah.
And a patch. Use a ship-to-shore radio to telephone patch. So you had a machinist responsible for the pretty much solely for the generation of power, although oftentimes powerhouse machinist would moonlight a little bit along with an electrician, because usually the powerhouse machinist is a competent electrician as well. But any cannery I was ever at also had a machinist who was, we call it a machinist, but he's really an electrician. We call him a machinist because he's part of the same union, part of the same crew, but every cannery had at least one dedicated electrician, and usually one or two electrician's helpers, along with a powerhouse machinist who could do electrical work in a pinch, or perhaps help the electrician out with a large job, and if it was a big enough job, there's contractors to go along with that. Also, a plumber. Every cannery generally needs a dedicated plumber. There's gobs of plumbing in a cannery, and there's usually always numerous malfunctioning plumbing issues. If they're not in the residential spaces, then they're in the production spaces. But usually that plumber, his duties were for all of it. Whether it was a toilet in bunkhouse A or a flume, a pipe delivering water that wasn't happening to a flume in the fish house. It didn't matter. There was a plumber dedicated to that part of the process. Along with that, the port engineers were also machinists. So the group that took care of the fishing fleet were a machinist, and I don't remember how many years toward the end, but my position that I chose to have during the last few years was shop machinist, which is usually, the primary duties there are usually to man the machine shop itself, which is to manufacture parts, whether it's manufacture parts for the cannery or perhaps the welder fabricator, because you also have a welder, a dedicated welder. So typically you have at least one person, and a lot of times, depending on the needs, a cannery may have two or three full-time welders dedicated, not to mention usually one, two, three, maybe a number of the machinists might also be competent welders. So you may draw, if you've got a big project, you might have a shop machinist, a first machinist, or even a filler man or somebody else that knows how to weld come in and also be welding, depending on the size of the project. So that those welders, they're also part of the machine, the machinist crew. And as I said, shop machinist may, in my case, do welding, manufacture parts for anything in the cannery that might break, because you keep a huge cache of parts for all that machinery. Plus, you have other canneries all over the place, and readily available air transportation. So oftentimes, if you have a broken part, you might bum from another cannery, but you may also just end up against the wall where you're down and you have to manufacture it. You don't have a choice because there's just not available. And the same goes for the boats. There may be some sort of mechanical part or equipment that might need both machinist and welding skills to remanufacture a part that will get that boat back on the water or that piece of canning equipment back online, whatever the case might be. So those were other machinist positions as well. Would be, like I said, you sort of had the core of the cannery, and then after that, you had powerhouse man, electrician, plumber, shop machinist, port engineers, electricians, etc. Well, like I say, chink man, filler man, seamer man, can shop man in the early years, salmon cook, boiler man, powerhouse man, electrician, plumber, at least two port engineers, but almost always three. We're up to what, 12? Mm-hmm. Shop machinist, 13. First machinist, 14. So, in Naknek he was 15. At least in pretty much in any given cannery, you're going to have at least 15 primary machinists and at least probably 4 to 6 helpers, 4 to 6 machinist helpers or apprentices, whatever the case. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did the cannery foreman do?
Well, for one, he was responsible to hire a competent crew. He was responsible to advise management on who the competent crew was, how many people he needed. Management had decided was the needs of a given season, the foreman would be responsible to make decisions about how soon the crew needed to be there in order to get the jobs done in time for the season start. He would be responsible to see to, I mentioned the parts that needed to be in inventory in the event that they were, you had a breakdown. He would be responsible to see to it that that inventory of parts was adequate. He would be ultimately responsible to see to it that that all of that equipment was in working order. Thus, typically, he was always a machinist also. Cannery foreman would, as I said, be the last word in evaluating whether or not, it doesn't matter what the piece of equipment was, whether it was that iron chink, or a filler, or a seamer, or a can shop piece of machinery, or even that bright stacker, whether or not that piece of machinery was during the season in good working order, and if it wasn't, what needs to be done to it, and at the end of the season, whether it was in good working order, and if it's not, is it something that we need to do before we leave, when we come back, or do we need to take it home with us and work on it? So cannery foreman would be responsible for all of that. Along with that, cannery foreman would be basically responsible to see to it that his crew was at to work on time every day, doing their work in a diligent way. How many hours need to be worked? Cannery foreman would be typically, along with the superintendent, they would generally brainstorm seasons 15 days away. Do we need to add some hours here? Or are we really caught up? Maybe we need to cut back a little bit here. But usually it's the other way around. Usually a couple of weeks before the season starts, you're going to have a cannery foreman going, getting a little itchy and going, I don't feel like I'm ready. Let's start working some midnights here for a little while. Stuff like that. Decide, well, you know, I just need my filler man and my shop machinist, or my filler man and my seamer man to work till midnight. Every place else is in good shape now. Or he may have a big part. But ultimately, the cannery, it's a little bit of a misnomer from cannery to cannery. In some canneries, you have a cannery machinist and a machinist foreman. So you have a cannery foreman and a machinist foreman. And in other canneries, you have just a machinist foreman who operates as a foreman of the whole cannery, basically. But then you have, even in that event, you have an indoor foreman and an outdoor foreman. So you mentioned that you had visited with Bob and Sylvia Mativier earlier. In the case of South Naknek, in the later years, we actually had three. We had Bob Deere as a machinist foreman, sort of the inside foreman, but that doesn't mean everything's all inside. Bob Mativier, sort of an outside foreman, but that doesn't mean everything's outside. So your outside foreman, he's going to look after the duties of the beach crew, the beach gang, the folks that go out and get fish delivered to the tenders, the folks that deliver them off the tenders, the folks that drive the pilings, and the outside foreman is going to take care of, as I said, it's not all outside. He's going to look after the carpenter crew. You're going to have a complement of carpenters as well at a cannery like that. He's probably going to that outside foreman and that inside foreman, machinist foreman, I should call him. So you're kind of going to have a beach foreman and a machinist foreman. They're going to work cooperatively with those port engineers, that powerhouse group, those welders, and that shop machinist, because those are all going to cross over. Sometimes they're going to be working on things in the kitchen. Sometimes they're going to be working things on a boat. Sometimes they're going to be working on things in a cannery. Remember, if we need some fiberglass work inside the cannery, well, that's a carpenter. So now we need that outside foreman to come in there and help direct the needs of this inside job. So then, as I said, in the later years, in the case of South Naknek, we also had a cannery foreman, and her duties were the actual processing crew, the processing people, the slimers, the people that fed the fish into the fillers, the kind of to coordinate all those people. The machinist foreman's got enough to do without having to deal with that as well. But in a lot of canneries in the earlier years, the machinist foreman, in fact, in Dexter's case, operating as a cannery foreman, he was the machinist foreman and the processing crew foreman, as was Jim Johnson at South Naknek when I first went there. So they didn't really have a person whose title was simply to look after the processing crew in some places, depending on the size of the operation and the needs. Yeah. So, well, this is all fine and dandy, but I mean, there is not a VHS machine in here, dear. Yeah.
Found.
I do have one out. I have a VHS machine out in the shop, and
cool.
I just have to go through this stuff. This is Bristol Bay Fishing, 1970 to 1985. This is a master tape of Naknek canneries, as is this one. I'm not sure what we got here. This is the new line we installed in Naknek, probably in about 1989. Anyway.
So you went from being first machinist to shop machinist. And is that where you stayed? Or were there other jobs over the years?
Well, shop machinist, you still end up kind of floating around because there aren't that many things that need to be made all the time, especially once the cannery's finally operating. Hopefully stuff isn't breaking that much. So you float. You float from need to need. I had gotten to where I didn't really want to... I think my title was shop. I think my title was first machinist at that point in time, but I think I was operating as the shop machinist as well, because I don't remember us having a first machinist those last couple of years. But I had gotten to where I kind of didn't want to do the hours that were required for those specialist positions, because they were pretty rough. And I didn't want to do them. So, I had enough hours as it was. I still worked till midnight every day. I didn't want to work till 3:30 or 4 in the morning every day. So, only to go to bed for an hour and get back up and work some more. So, and I had my kids up there and Janet. Yeah. So yeah, that was the last position. 1995 was the last year I was there, and I pretty much worked in the capacity of a shop machinist during those last couple of years, I think. So.
So from 1981 to 1995, you were South Naknek, except for
1984. Yeah, except for 1984, we took a detour. Yeah.
To go to Ucanic.
Right. So what? 14 years? 13, 14 years? Yeah.
What was the union that you belonged to?
That would have been the International Association of machinists and aerospace workers. So it would be the same union that the Boeing machinist would be in, for example. But in 1986, 1986 or 1987, the South Naknek was first cooperatively run, I think, and then ultimately purchased from ConAgra. So it went under, it operated under the name Sea Alaska in 1985, and maybe in 1986. For certain, it operated under the name Sea Alaska Seafoods or Sea Alaska Fisheries, I can't remember, in 1985, possibly in 1986. At that point, and Sea Alaska was in part subsidiary to ConAgra, I think, and in part Fisherman's Co-op. And then it was bought by Trident Seafoods. And when it was bought by Trident Seafoods, Gary Johnson called me and said he wanted to arrange a meeting, wondered if I could come down to Lake Union. So I drove down there, and he said, "I got some good news and some bad news." He said, "The bad news is you're fired." And he said, "In fact, the bad news is everybody's fired. So the good news is, if you're willing to come back to work for us with these benefits but no union, you can have your job back." So that's how Trident broke the union when they bought the plant.
That opened up at South Naknek.
That was South. But no, but the meeting was in. It was in Seattle. The meeting was in Seattle, probably in February or March prior to the season, because they broke the union. They separated from the union, and there was no way that they were going to be able to hire somebody under the pretense that they were a union. They were union help. Then get them up there, and then so you needed to clear with your union down here anywhere way typically before you could go up, but. But I mean that's literally how it was presented. You no longer have a job here unless you're willing to come back to work for us. In other words, they couldn't say, "Well, we're changing the platform from now on. If you want to work here, you have to work here as a non-union employee." I think the process was legal that way. I think it had to be that you needed to be terminated and rehired.
And what did you
in order for that to be a legal process? Well, I wasn't happy with it at all. In my case, we had established this pattern where my wife and my kids were coming up there, and we were being accommodated. They were paying their airfare and their room and their board, and they were employing Janet, and the kids were well accommodated, it's already February or March, and I don't want to lose my union, but boy, trying to regenerate that whole process with a union plant on that short timeline was more than a tall order. So I didn't even try. I just said, "Okay, well, we'll do it," and parts of it looked better and parts of it looked worse. Retrospectively, I would be better off had it stayed union the whole time. I end up with a vested pension from the machinist union, but it would have been a lot better vested pension if.
Mm-hmm. Did anything else change because you were no longer a union shop?
Oh, they had the ability to change a lot of things. And, I think I think probably at other Trident plants, things changed a lot more than they changed at South Naknek. Gary Johnson tried really hard to kind of protect the process there and keep things kind of the way that they were when it was a union plant. Because all of those things kind of came into question all of a sudden. The union guaranteed a lot of things, like shipping your tools up without a fee. They guaranteed that room and board. They guaranteed that laundry was done. They guaranteed that if you didn't get 4 hours off the clock in a 24-hour period, that the following day was time and a half in addition to your normal wages, because the union guaranteed guaranteed a minimum. So that was maybe one of the most glaring things, was is that with the union, been too many years to know, there may have been the company may have had an out in the short run. In other words, if you were hired and then, let's say, the cannery burned down a week later, maybe they were hold harmless there. But if you were there for 6 weeks and the cannery burned down, you still got your union contract. You got paid. That was part of the deal. As a non-union plant, you were swinging in the wind. With respect to that, it was an honor deal. You know, if the company wanted to pay it to you, they could, but it certainly didn't have to. And that's what I mean by Gary Johnson was pretty diligent about protecting a lot of things that we had become accustomed to as union protections. But of course, that was all still just kind of handshake stuff. The one thing that was added in was there was now a 401k that was available, but there was no pension plan anymore. So the double time and a half thing, so to speak, I think at South Naknek that kind of stayed intact in spite of the fact that it wasn't a union plant anymore. But I doubt if Triton ordered that anywhere else. And really, Gary's accident had a lot to do with my decision to quit going north. I was kind of burnt out on the process anyway, especially the part about having to take my family up and all of the rest of it. And Gary, first he had the accident, and then ultimately the plant started looking more and more like it was becoming less and less viable. I was looking at the whole process like, I'm not afforded those same protections anymore. Gary's not going to stand between me and Trident upper management, Chuck, and if I go try to play hardball with Chuck Bundrant, he's going to laugh at me. So that was kind of the inspiration, I guess, to just kind of give up the Alaska thing. It was either that or search out another company, preferably a union job again, that was willing to take my family on. Because I didn't want to go up without them. I'd gotten used to going with them, and I didn't want to do it any other way. So Gary was good enough to protect that whole time, including the family going up and the whole thing. As long as he was there and he was as viable as he had been, I probably would have continued to go indefinitely. But after his accident, that all fell apart, and that was kind of the beginning of the end of it for me.
Were you a part of when the cannery started to really incorporate freezing into the process?
No.
Okay.
It, Excursion Inlet was a freezer processor all the time that I was there. And at Excursion Inlet, some of my duties did include maintenance issues in the freezer plant. Everything at South Naknek, even when the frozen market started to get really more viable than the cannery market, their fish was either contracted, shipped across the river and frozen, or of course Trident had quite a processing fleet, quite a fleet of freezer processors afloat. I don't know that even after we were gone, the South Naknek ever became any appreciative freezer. Maybe they put some little plate freezer in there or something after I left there for a year or two, but because it didn't run that long after I left there. It was never really a freezer plant. They had a couple of freezer vans there, and they froze a little bit of fish, but that wasn't a freezer plant.
How did South Naknek compare to the other canneries that you worked? What made it different or special?
I think probably the biggest difference between South Naknek and all the other plants is that South Naknek is a community. It's a village, it's in proximity to a much larger village, and that much larger village is in proximity to a much larger village yet. The other canneries truly were a self-contained. As I said, at South Naknek, you had a public power utility. You had a little village with employees, with locals who would employ at the cannery every year. You had a little bit of that at Larsen Bay, but not nearly as much as you do at South Naknek. Larsen Bay, when I was there, I know it's a completely different place now than it was then, but when I was at Larsen Bay, it was a very primitive Alaskan Native village. There was no stores. It was truly a subsistence lifestyle for the residents there. And of course, at Excursion Inlet and Yuganik Bay, Excursion Inlet maybe as a slight village in that there were a few of us displaced Southerners that spent most of the winter up there as caretakers and stuff. So there was a little bit of a contingent of folks like us from the South that had displaced there, or at least part-time. The beach boss there, Norman DeRozier, who would have kind of been the closest connection to what Bob Mateever's job was at South Naknek, he bought a piece of property. He owned land at Excursion Inlet. And then, he also owned land down in Georgia. And so, I think Georgia. But anyway, Excursion Inlet was a slight village, but not really a village with culture, but of course South Naknek is a village with a culture, and a school, and a bar, and a church, and so it was different in that way, and that actually changes things quite a bit. Is that, again, I mentioned the Norm DeRozier dynamic as being sort of comparable to Bob Mateever, but Bob Mateever came in late April or early May and left in late July or early August, and that was that. Norm DeRoser at the other place was kind of a part-time, full-time, you know, he owned property there. He lived there much of the year, just as Carvel Zimmon Sr. would have been in that position at South Naknek. So in other words, in a way, Carvel Zimmon was more like the Norm DeRozier than Bob Ativier was, in that Carvel Zimmon was there all year round and was sort of an outside boss, sort of an outside caretaker, maintenance person, etc., of that plant year round. That changes a lot of things about a plant when you have a liaison that has that much clout, that much working knowledge of the place, everything else. In some seasons, Carvel would take his village beach crew and assemble the whole water flume assembly thing from the lake before the down south crew even got there. Make the place ready before everybody even got there. At other places, I mean, when we flew into Euganic Bay, we threw our bags out of a float plane into a seine skiff, and we threw our bags onto a pallet that was hoisted up onto the dock, and we crawled up the dock ladders. And when we got there, there was about six of us, in that probably included Jeannie, who lived across the bay, who had decided to hire on and cook for a few days, and we got it all going. I mean, there was nothing there. I wasn't, you know, there wasn't electricity until we showed up and started up the generator. I mean, there wasn't nothing. So some of those canneries were a lot more primitive as far as accommodating you than South Naknek. Mm-hmm. South Naknek was pretty accommodating. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What about the size or the scope of the cannery? Was that similar?
South Naknek's really huge, sprawled out cannery. That was another thing that makes it complex, but at the same time, having that, having the ability to have part of a crew be there year round and have that kind of a working knowledge. Like I said, if you might have a different plumber every year, but Carvel Zimmon knew where every pipe in the place was. Yeah. So, mm-hmm.
Was it different also, working it just as a machinist, the difference of having such an intense and short season in Bristol Bay?
Absolutely.
Versus,
absolutely. Yeah. Oh, for sure. And yeah. It's pretty intense. Mm-hmm. South Naknek's pretty intense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That run is so short and so big that yet none of the other cannery, well, no, Euganic Bay, there was a fair number of sleepless nights there, but that was more about the fact that that was a shoestring operation, a shoestring crew, and, you know, and it was a big run. It was an unusually big pink run that year. But, you know, at South Naknek, you could pretty well figure that from about June 15th until July 15th to July 20th, you're probably going to be putting in a 16 to 20 hour day every day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Over the years that you were there, what would you say are the major changes to the canning line and the machines? You mentioned the reformer going away with the stackable plants. Were there other shifts in technology or processing that you noted or that impacted your work?
There was a lot of shifts in technology. During the time I worked there, the means of delivering fish to the fish house from the tender, forget the name of the equipment, I think there was two different manufacturers, but one it created basically a huge vacuum cleaner. So you could basically, and they're still in use today, basically. The beach gang no longer necessarily, depending on the type of tender they were working with, didn't necessarily have to shove all the fish off the tender through a little gate. They could now suck them through a humongous tube, through a vacuum cleaner, basically, and blow them into the fish house. So that's certainly a significant technological piece of equipment that was changed. In the years that I worked there, everything changed from... Larson Bay was all line shaft drives, and much of South Naknek was line shaft drives when I started working for them. Just about everything was individually motorized per machine. And by the time I stopped working there, South Naknek, Gary, they kind of decided to try and reinvent the wheel a little bit there. So they came up with some innovative patching table stuff that, when we finally got the bugs all worked out of it, might have worked better than the old way. But it certainly had its problems for a time. They installed some weighing machines to replace the gravity weighing machines with electronic weighing machines. So that's a significant change. The old style had a fairly complex piece of equipment. I forget now how many scales were on it, but if you can just think of a beam scale, the can was delivered basically onto a machine that rotated in a long oval rotating fashion, and had, as I said, I should remember because I've taken that thing apart from the bottom to the top, but I don't remember, it's been too many years, how many were actually on it, but there was a couple of dozen beams on that that you set with a can that you'd already weighed to scale, a too light, a too heavy, and a just right, and it was all a mechanical beam scale operation where all the cans went around this long rotation and were weighed. In later years, that machine was eliminated, and a machine that just sensed the can coming through, weighed it, and if it didn't like it, it had a little hammer, a little trigger with a rubber bumper on it that come out and smack the can out. Just knocked it out and said, nope, you're too light. And on they went. And then on the other end, I don't know that American can seamers even would have been compatible with it, but we had a sensor that was designed in Germany, and actually the somebody from the German designer came out and tried to install these things on the seamers help them monitor pressures on the seams. I don't think they ever got them working right. So I think that was a technological advancement that probably failed. I don't remember it ever, them ever getting it working right in my time there. Seems to me like they gave up on it. Bright stackers got more efficient. They developed a better means of doing that. That didn't mean they didn't use the old ones. Still, the equipment was expensive, but they came up with better bright stackers, better generators. Over the course of from 1976 to 1995, there was a lot of things throughout the process and in the boats as well. This is a picture of the old office This is the original office at South Naknek. And you've been there, I assume. So you're familiar with this building. So we inhabited the whole left side of that office. Well, there was apartments on the other side in the later years. But that was where we lived. That was where we lived in the later years when the whole family went up. The first year I went up to South Naknek in 1981, I lived in just one of the bunkhouse rooms, as I had. Machinists, typically, they always had bunkhouses that were kind of sectioned out for the longer term help and the shorter term help and the fishermen. So usually there would be a machinist bunkhouse that would be exclusive to machinists and carpenters. Occasionally they might have the cook living in there or something else like that too. They might have the beach gang living in there. But rarely, if ever, would you have a member of the greater cannery in that bunkhouse. So anyway, I live in those bunkhouses. The first year I went up, I actually lived in right next to the White House with my dad, briefly, but then I ended up going to a bunkhouse. But then excursion in a bunkhouse, same at Uganic Bay. And at Uganic Bay, we both had a room in the bunkhouse. And in 1981, when we went to South Naknek, I went up, she came up a month later, and we lived in a bunkhouse room in the machinist bunkhouse. Until my oldest daughter was born, and I moved into the old office. That would have been 1986. 1986, I moved in the old office, and I stayed in there from then on. Although I think that I started out with a little bit less space and expanded over time. I glommed onto some extra rooms in there as time went by, remodeled a little bit and everything.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And so it was actually a pretty comfortable apartment. Pretty much had everything, all the accommodations we needed in our own bathroom, bathtub, shower, and two bedrooms, a living room, a foyer, a little place to cook.
Wow, that's luxurious.
I even put a kitchen sink in there. It was pretty comfortable for the family to be in it.
Mm-hmm. Who else was able to have their own living quarters outside of bunkhouse?
The cannery foreman, Bob Deere, would have there, and pretty much, generally that benefit was usually extended to cannery foremen to have their family come and stay, and usually, not always, but usually the cannery foreman was usually accommodated with a house of some kind, as was Bob Mativier and Sylvia Mativier. And oftentimes, the first machinist would also have his family accommodated, and so as in this case. So,
and the superintendent, of course.
Now, obviously, the superintendent would be accommodated with a house, and his family would be accommodated as well. Uh-huh. So, yeah. Other than that, there really weren't any families there. My brother-in-law worked there for a couple of seasons as the powerhouse guy, the guy that ran the generators, and he had his family up there in the little the little chicken coop just down the walkway from the White House there. Yeah, just up the walkway from this. Mm-hmm. From the back side of this.
What did they just call your house, the old office then?
did.
Mm-hmm. And you moved in after they brought in trailers and moved the office into the trailers? Is that how?
No. I mean, there was an office there was an office before the trailers on the I'm sure it's still there, downstream, downriver from the White House. There was another house that probably accommodated about 4 or 5 office spaces.
The hotel.
Hmm?
Oh,
is
that what you're talking about?
The hotel.
The hotel.
Was that what we called the hotel in later on?
Yes,
because
there was
in
the nurse and that was the hotel.
Earlier on, that was the office.
Yeah,
before the trailers were brought in, that was the office.
The hotel.
Then it was called the hotel.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
The
hotel was originally the office. So this was originally the office, and then the hotel, in later years, became the office, and then the trailers were moved in.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
And the trailers were moved in at the time of Trident. I probably moved in here a year before Trident took over.
Mm-hmm.
And then at least a year. And that was when Trident took over. That's when the offices expanded to trailers as well. Yeah, to the. Mm-hmm.
So Katie asked me to ask you about the ghost of the Indian shop.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
he woke me up in the middle of the night.
So we spoke about the that line shaft drive thing, and that the cans were elevated from machine to machine. So they would come out of a reformer, for example, or a clincher. They would be sent up on a belt. A belt would under tension, would tension them, would drive them up into a gravity feed chute. And each of these elevators, can elevators, had a magnetic clutch on it, and they would need maintenance periodically, as would the belt shaft drive itself. And one morning, real early, like a couple hours before time for the cannery to operate, so maybe 5-6 o'clock in the morning, and I was in the can shop, and I went to go up there to just either do maintenance or repair something that was broken, and I climbed up. Because there was ladders periodically along the way, so you could get up there and maintain that stuff. And I climbed up that ladder, and just as I got to the top of it, I just glanced towards the end of the building where the web locker was, and I saw the upper torso of a figure, not a face, just a torso. It was as if there was a face, but it had turned before I could see it. I guess what printed on me the most was just that it was a large figure. A large upper body torso, and it was wearing like a large quilted shirt, like a plaid red or orangish plaidish shirt, and it was sort of like this fleeting thing. Where I crossed the threshold of that ladder, I looked that direction, and it was like there was a person, but in the blink of an eye, it wasn't there anymore. So it was this apparition of this torso and this shirt and whatnot. And I mentioned it to Mick. I mentioned it to her, maybe the same day or that night. I mentioned it to Mick Connolly, who had worked up there a couple of years earlier, in the coming days. I just asked him, I said, "Hey, Mick, have you ever seen a ghost up in the can shop?" And it was matter of fact. He just turned around, smiled, he said, "Fleeting glimpses now and then." Whether he was serious or it was just a joke. But it was only probably not more than a week or so. And Kathy, I'm forgetting Kathy's last name, but I had mentioned that at South Naknek we had a cannery foreman and an outside foreman and a machinist foreman. And Kathy was the cannery worker foreman. And I think it was unconspired that Kathy's...
And there was a Scott.
Well, Scott was a little bit later on, and Scott claimed to have seen it as well. But the thing about it with Kathy was she said something... I had not conspired with her at all. All she knew was that I had mentioned to Mick that about this joke, about this deal, and whether it was a joke or not a joke, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, I saw your ghost last night. And I said, "You're kidding me." She said, "Nope, I saw your ghost last night." I said, "Well, if you saw my ghost, what color shirt was he wearing?" And she said, "I think it was like a red plaid shirt." Well, her and I had not had a communication over this apparition, other than that she knew that I had seen a ghost. But as far as Janet was the only person I had mentioned the color of clothing to, and she had not talked to anybody about it. So that was kind of that ongoing ghost story of the strange apparition, where both Kathy and I had witnessed the same basic vision, all the way down to the color of clothing. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a really old safe in the office from the 1800s, a freestanding safe that undoubtedly that's where Alaska Packers kept all the gold back in the 1800s. And that was in that office, and the last year or a year or two before I left there, I mentioned to Gary that I'd like to have that safe. And I ended up bringing that safe back home with me, and I had it in the basement of my house when I lived in Fairhaven. And when we moved out here, I didn't have a good place. It was heavy, it was hard to move, and I didn't have a good place put the safe, so I gave it to my neighbor who happened to be a locksmith. By that time, we had already opened the safe. But before we opened the safe, I had a dream one night. And in the dream, we opened the safe. And of course, I always hoped maybe there'd be something cool in the safe. There was nothing in the safe when we opened the safe. But I had a dream one night, and when we opened the safe, the only thing that was in that safe was a plaid shirt.
Wow. But there was nothing.
No, ultimately, when we did open the safe, there was nothing in it. But boy, you can imagine when we were opening the safe, the anticipation, the possibility that there would be a plaid shirt in that safe was high.
I remember you telling me that you almost yelled at the person, that the apparition, because you were wondering what they were doing up there.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was... It was very real in the moment, but at the same time, it was mid-season, and I mentioned to Janet later that day, I said, you know, I've only had like, you know, 10 hours of sleep in the last 10 days. So who knows, you know, I might just be seeing things here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Kathy conspired it that I really took it seriously at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So.
Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you'd like to say before
we talk? I would say that ghost sightings at South Naknek are not uncommon.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, when you first arrived, did you ever go to the Chinese cemetery?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
How many graves were there that you remember?
Well, there was a fenced-in area of Chinese graves, it seems to me. There was a lot of graves there.
I took a rubbing of one of the... I wonder if I still have it.
Probably.
I probably still have it up in the... Of one of the...
One of the stones.
Headstone.
Mm.
But, of course, they weren't all Chinese graves. There were graves of other Cambry people as well. Expired while they were up there.
I see.
You know, but I think probably most of it was Chinese.
Mm.
There was a lot of graves.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. There, I mean, by a lot, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if there was 50 graves there.
Wow.
I don't know.
Huh. Yeah. Now it's absolutely overgrown by alders. And so
is it? There's nothing, you can't see anything? Uh-huh. Oh,
I'll
really?
Look for that
one. Wow.
It would be up in the filing cabinet.
The brown filing cabinet?
Yeah.
Well, I can walk up there and look while you're talking.
Manila envelope.
Oh. Hmm. I'll look through that.
Okay.
I'll go up and look at it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I will have to review these.
Yes.
We'll get back to you on it. I'll get with Katie on this when I get these reviewed. And maybe we can recommit these to discs or cards or something. And yeah. Mm-hmm.
That'd be great. Well, I think I'm going to move this closer to you, Janet, so that I can.
Well, why don't we just move Janet?
Oh, perfect. Yes.
I'll walk up and take a look.
So, Janet. Similar beginning question.
Yes.
Where were you born, and what was it that brought you to your first Alaska cannery?
I was born in Seattle, Washington. I was a hairdresser at Greenwood Salon, and I had a client, Mrs. Johnson. Can't remember her first name, but it was summer of. It was becoming the summer of 1980, and she had told me about her son being foreman at Larson Bay, Alaska, and I was buying a horse at the time, and she had told me that if I wanted to get a cannery job, it was a really good experience, and if I wanted to go up there, I could buy my horse with my first check instead of trying to save and buy it my whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so you were convinced.
So I was convinced, and I went. And first thing I ever, I was 21 years old, and just said, "Okay, let's do it."
So tell me about that first summer.
Well, it was gosh, a lot for, you know, I still lived at home at the time. Well, no, I did not. I did not live at home. I lived with some roommates in Bothell, Linwood area. But I went up there. I worked first. When we first got up there, we did repair to the cannery, painting and cleaning, and I found out that I was going to be assigned to the egg house. So I packed salmon roe all summer and made wood boxes, packed salmon roe, learned a little bit of Japanese. We go for long walks. It was quite primitive there at Larson Bay back in 1980. The mountain that first year, well, within a couple days of just being there with a group, about 10 of us. And I'm looking along the trail and I'm seeing this brown curly hair, and I'm going, oh my gosh, we're following a bear trail. And pretty quick I could smell something, and you know, every part of me saying, turn around. And we get to a clearing, and part of our group is standing there, and there's a great big Kodiak bear up on his haunches. And that's the first experience I ever had with my knees going weak. But so it was quite a eye-opener for me, just the difference in culture and you know.
So can you describe working in the egg house?
Working at the egg house was cold and damp. You would have to, these eggs would be brine, put in brine, and then you'd get a big pile of eggs, and you would have to put them in a box, and it had to be really neat, and it had to be presented really nicely, because they sold those boxes of eggs for, I have no idea, hundreds of dollars. And you did that all day.
So where in the process were the eggs removed from the salmon, and then?
They were taken at the fish house, and so there was a, they cut the belly and it was sucked out, if I remember right. And so I never, you saw that part, but that would have been at the very beginning of when they went onto the iron chink, and it was sucked out, and then they would bring baskets of eggs over and brine them. Yeah.
And who oversaw your work?
The Japanese crew from Japan. They'd have workers, and they'd have the head foreman, and they would walk behind you and make sure you did it just right. Most of them didn't speak English, but they usually did have one person that could speak English real well, and he would say, no, we need you to do this and this.
Who worked in the egg house of the cannery crew? Was it any person that wanted to, or was it considered a special job? Was it?
You know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think they just decided. It was mostly women, mostly girls. Yeah.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I can't remember. Well, that's not true. I think, if I remember right, the women did the packing of the eggs, except for the Japanese crew. They were all men. And the guys, the men that worked there would do the forklift and heavier stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if it was cultural or exactly what, why. But
uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the composition in general of the crew back in 1980? Was it college students? Was it mostly Filipinos, local native people?
It was mostly young adults, college.
Did you have to be a member of the union?
When I first started there, yes.
Mm.
Yeah. It was a union job.
What union? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
So, did you sign up at this union hall, or once you got to Larson Bay, do you remember that?
No, I don't think Larson Bay was union.
Mm.
I honestly don't remember.
Mm, okay.
Yeah.
So, what happened after that summer?
Well, that's where I met Harvey, and we went home. We didn't start dating till I went home. And then he went to South Naknek the next year, and he went up, and then I got a position after he'd been up there. I got a position and was flowing up there, and I worked in the egg house there as well.
Was it different at all than Larson Bay?
Not really. It was. It seemed more business-like in with that group. The Larson Bay was a little bit funner group. Yeah.
What was your first impression of South Naknek and the cannery when you arrived?
My first impression was it was huge. It was huge, and I wondered, what did I get myself into? But, you know, everybody there ends up being your friends, kind of an extended family, including the village and the natives that we worked with, the locals.
And so that first summer, you lived in a bunkhouse, or?
We lived up in the top floor of the machinist bunkhouse. The second room, I believe. Yeah.
And what were your meals like?
Our meals, we'd have a breakfast, and we'd have, I think it was a 10 o'clock mug up, and then lunch, and then a 3 o'clock mug up, and then dinner, and then a 7 o'clock mug up, I think, and a 9 o'clock meal where you go to the mess hall.
Would you eat them at all of the meals?
Oh gosh, no. I wondered why. Why did they feed so much food? It was, I think it was, had to do with union contracts. They'd have to be fed so many hours.
I see. So that first summer was Egg House again.
It was Egg House. I think I was in the Egg House for 2 years. And then I remember walking into the cannery, because Harb was down in the cannery. And I can't remember if I was just walking over there or if I was going to go to work over there as a patcher. But Gary Johnson was there, and he asked me if I wanted to be, if I wanted to work in the mess hall that year. And I said, yes, of course I do. And so he made me promise I would keep smiling if I worked in there, and I said I will. And so I started as a waitress in the mess hall.
So why did you want to do that instead of work in the egg house?
I didn't have to wear rain gear, and I didn't have to smell like fish all the time. And it was dry, often too warm, but it was dry. So I ended up working in, it was called the Blue Room, and that was the machinist room where I was the waitress in there. So I would bring their food in there, and it was a buffet style, where they would enter from the back side of the regular mess hall, and they would come in and they would go down a buffet style. And my job was just to keep the food, make sure everything
couldn't
was full
it.
Enough.
Okay. Might either. Sea Alaska Products Incorporated was the name of the company.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was my job. I did that.
And this was 1986.
Okay.
So that was my job, was to make sure that there was enough food for the machinist room. It included the machinist, cannery foreman, and
was there another room in the mess hall?
There was the main mess hall, and then there was the white call. Was it called the white call room? It was this room here. It was painted yellow, and I didn't go up in 1985, and because I had my daughter was born, and I stayed home with her. That was too hard being away from him. And so the next year I went up, and I told Gary that I would do both rooms, because he wanted to know if there was some way I could do both rooms. And I said, yep, if you cut a hole in it. So Gary had the machinists or the carpenters cut a hole, and then I served both rooms.
The blue room and the yellow room?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So tell me about the day in the life of a mess hall waitress.
Mess hall waitress. Well, okay, let's go back to when I first started there. Mug up time, well, first of all, we'd get up and we would serve breakfast. And that was, breakfast was always out in the main mess hall. And we'd make sure all the condiments were there, and we had to make coffee. It was an old steam coffee pot. So it you had to big coffee pot and have to get we couldn't make coffee unless the boiler was running. So we'd have to get the coffee pot steam up to ready to spill over onto the coffee grounds, and you had to do it slow, but you had to get it just right, otherwise it would blow and make them like blow steam everywhere. So you had to get it just right, and if you went too fast, it would burn the coffee. So you had to get it just right and kind of brew it slowly. They finally replaced that. But I was a good coffee maker. And what else? So we would basically just, you know, make sure they had everything out and clean. We'd wipe down tables, clean up any messes. And then we would, start setting up for our, lunch and stuff. But we always had a mug up in between. And back then, we'd have these big totes of coffee and hot water. And they would be on a cart. And then we'd have trays of cookies and donuts, whatever mug up it was. It was typically pastries in the morning, and afternoon it was cookies. And so we'd put these pastries on, and we'd have to push this huge cart down the boardwalk. And, you got to know that boardwalk, because if you didn't hit it right, your coffee would fly off the carts. And, you'd have to pick it back up and put it back on. So you got to really learn the boardwalk. And you'd take it all the way down to the cannery. There were, I think, two or three different carts you'd had to bring down each mug up. And then they started to replace it with a Cushman, which was a lot nicer.
And it's a
motorized, like a little cart that has a spot in the back. My daughter worked with me then, she was a baby, but I had a backpack, and I would not sit in the cart. I would hold off to the side as she was in my backpack and ride down with them. She got to know everybody's name in the cannery as a young child, as an infant or a toddler. And she'd wave and say hi to everybody. And they had said that how they thought they should hire her up in the office, because she could remember names. She at any of our meals that were out in the main dining room, I had a little clamp on seat, and Gary would always sit right across from her, and he would take a little spot on his tray and puts food on there for him. He'd tell him, this is yours, you can eat off of this. So he kind of got to be the grandpa, I guess. I don't know.
Who's that?
Gary Johnson. For Sarah.
Kinda.
Yeah.
Where would you serve the mug up?
Mug up was down over there. Was
one in the early season, it would serve out in the mess hall.
it depended. Every mug up in the early season was in the mess hall?
Typically.
Oh, you're right.
Until more
until all the crew got there.
Yeah.
That we would all walk up to the to the
they would take their little Cushman and haul it down to the canneries.
At the early season, before the cannering crew and everybody got there, we would walk up to the.
Of course, it wouldn't be efficient if the whole crew went to the mess hall for it.
We'd walk up to the mess hall, and then after the crew got, we had mug up down on the face of the dock. There was one or two carts there, and then there was one over by the fish house, or
okay.
Actually egg house.
So there were
back
different
in the
stations.
There were different stations.
Okay.
Those are the ones I remember.
So then there's mug up,
mm-hmm.
and then
there would be a dinner, and then an evening sandwich type right around 9 o'clock mug up, and then if the cannery went late enough, there'd be a midnight meal.
So your responsibility was bringing the food out, taking the food back.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Cleaning up, wiping everything down, helping with the salad maker, because there'd be a salad maker. There was a there was a head cook, there was an assistant cook. Well, then there was the kitchen, I don't know what to call it, kind of in charge of the kitchen, and then there was two cooks. He did some of the cooking as well. And then his wife was the baker in earlier years, and then there was a salad maker. And then there was three waitresses, maybe four waitresses.
What about dishwashers?
And thank you. So there was the head cook and the second cook, and then there was a dishwasher, but also he would do some of the cooking. That's where I was kind of not remembering. It's been a long time.
Yes.
Because I worked in the mess hall for until my second daughter, until after my second daughter was born, and then I went into the laundry.
Mm. So, you mentioned the cooks, and then the baker, and
mm-hmm.
the waitress. Were there any other people involved in the mess hall operation?
No.
So it wasn't a really big staff?
It was not a real big staff.
Mm.
There was a salad maker, the waitresses would be, you know, taking the food out, but it was all buffet style, so they would buffet style, where you just go down a line.
Where would the mess hall staff sleep?
Well, let me think. The cooks. Well, it was a cook, husband and wife. Later years it changed, but the husband and wife, there used to be two mess halls. One was the Filipino mess hall, and it was kind of back, it was side, kind of on the side of the mess hall, but it was since closed, and that was just storage, and they turned part of it into a shower room for the fishermen, but there was a couple rooms back there, and the cook and the head cook and his wife, the baker, stayed there, and their son, who was one of the cooks, stayed next to him. The dishwasher stayed in the machinist bunkhouse, and I stayed in the machinist bunkhouse until our daughter was born, and we stayed in that old office. And the other waitresses stayed in the women's bunkhouse.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where was the women's bunkhouse?
It's the very last one by the, it was the machinist bunkhouse, and then machinist bunkhouse was yellow, and then behind it
was the women's bunkhouse.
Okay.
Yeah. On some, there was also like the hospital where a lot of the women stayed. Mm. They were mostly the office women. They all worked in the office. And there was cannery foremans that were ladies that stayed there as well.
Mm. Okay. So, what was the best part about working in the mess hall?
Well, I got to have my daughter with me. That was really nice. And then we'd have a little, little playpen in the back, and getting to see, you know, the other machinists when they'd come in and their families, that were their spouses, and you know, visiting with, because you kind of got to be you were the center of the whole cannery because everybody came to you, and we always, you know, just making people happy, you know, pleasing them, they, you know, trying to make something special for them.
Were you involved at all with the ordering of the food or the planning of the menus or anything?
No.
Did, had the cook been there for a long time, or was that a...
I think he had, yeah. It was Don and Pat Graves. At least they'd been there, you know, before I was there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't actually know. I don't know how long they were there.
What were some of the favorite meals that people always expressed that they liked?
Oh, steak night. They always liked steak night.
And was that a certain day of the week, or?
Yes, but okay. I think it was a weekend. And then they always liked, they didn't like salmon night. I don't know why. And they liked, they had a lot of different entrees when they would, it would be just steak, you'd have something else with it. They fed them really, really well up there. It was like unbelievable. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask, why did you switch over to the laundry?
Because I had, I had my second daughter, and they're 4 years apart, so I worked in the mess hall for a long time before I switched over. And after she was born in 1989, there was a 4 year difference between them, and I was, the laundry was closer to my bunkhouse, and I could have a little bit more freedom. Clean the bunkhouses, make their beds, and I could have the kids with me. No, that's not right. I switched over before my second daughter, because I remember having her up in the bunkhouse, and in this particular bunkhouse, this person would chew snus, and it would have cups of it all over. And I set her out in the backpack and told her it was all no-no, she had to stay right there. So it was before my second child. I think it was just too many hours. It was too long of hours. In the middle of canning season, you know, the midnight meal, and then having a child. And, I didn't have to stay up till midnight in the laundry. I worked till 9 o'clock. 9:30, right in there every night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was why.
What sort of jobs did you do in the laundry?
Let's see, cleaning the bunkhouses. I did all the small areas, the White House, the Crow's Nest, the hotel, machinist bunkhouse. We did do the foreman's house and Bob Mativier's as well. Anyhow, you would clean, bring, change their sheets once a week, make their beds, give them clean towels every day. And then clean their bathrooms, clean the showers and the bunkhouses. And in the where the fishermen stayed and the Filipino bunkhouse, we just did the showers in there and cleaned the bathrooms and the showers and the common areas. And, you know, they had hotel rooms, not only in the hotel, but up in some of the bunkhouses that we would have to go in, and once the person was gone, we'd have to clean, you know, change the sheets, give them new towels. I guess we made the beds there every day as well, and gave them. Then we'd have to have this huge pile of laundry, and we'd have to, you know, clean it, fold it, put it away, start over again.
What was the frequency that you would make your rounds? Was it every couple of days you'd have to clean these?
Every day.
Mm-hmm. So every day you'd have to clean the bathroom and the
mm-hmm.
and the White House and
mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. You'd go in. Yeah.
That's some pretty lucky service for some of those people.
Well, every day in the
You gotta remember everybody's working all the time.
They're working all the time, so they want to go back and just get in.
That's why that union contract was written that way. Because, you know, if you work 16 to 20 hours a day, you don't have time to do your laundry, your bedding, your make your food, do all that stuff. I mean, you know. Typically, we would even hire somebody to do our
Not usually. They would bring up their clothes up to the laundry, and they would pay the laundry people to do it. If I was somewhere just to be nice, if the laundry had stopped and there was clothes sitting on it that were wet, I would take out what was dry, fold it, put it on top, and then put the wet stuff in. You know, just to help them out. But no, I didn't.
It was just the linens and all of
that.
Yeah,
just the linens and cleaning the rooms. And
Who worked in the laundry?
It was usually a couple of locals, Shirley Zimmon and Mary Brown. She drove the van, and so she'd have to do runs and pick people up. But she also worked in the laundry. Myself. So it was three local, and Denise, I don't remember Denise's last name. She worked there as well. So it was three local and myself.
And so Mary had the van, but everyone
mm-hmm.
else, was there any sort of job descriptions in the laundry, or if someone was responsible for this and another person for that?
Yeah, Shirley Zimmon was the head laundry person, so she stayed and did the laundry.
And then you and Denise and Mary would go and do the cleaning.
Mm-hmm. And Mary stayed in the laundry as well.
Okay.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it was mostly Denise and I. It seems like there might have been another person, but I don't remember. Later on, it was Helvey Anderson and her daughter Jeannie Stewart that I worked with in the laundry, and I believe Denise was still there as well.
And so, did you continue to work in the laundry for many years?
I worked in the laundry until 1995 when we stopped going up.
Okay,
yeah.
So you worked in the egg house, you worked in the mess hall, you worked in the laundry.
Yes.
Did you have other jobs at the cannery?
Well, when we first got there, we would have to do painting and scraping. I remember working down in the where did Bill work at, Harv? McKay?
Stockroom.
Stockroom. There we go. Yeah. Down in the stock room, sorting nuts and bolts and cleaning up. Because, you know, they gave you stuff to do before cannery started. That was before I worked in the laundry or the mess hall. Okay. They'd keep the cannery workers busy till the fish came. Okay. And before that, I also did a lot of sliming of the fish. And I worked as a patcher a few times.
Yeah. What was your favorite job of all of them?
I really liked the mess hall, but I couldn't keep the hours up with two kids. But I also really liked the laundry as well, because you got to meet a lot of people outside the cannery, people that came. Helicopter pilots. One time, in one of the trailers, it was the trailer right next to the laundry. It was one of the Trident upper guys locked himself out of the trailer, and so I looked at it, and I knew my daughter could fit through one of the little holes. So we unscrewed it, and I told her, okay, I want you just to go straight through and unlock the door. So, and she did, so she got paid for her first job being a locksmith. She got paid Cracker Jacks and a teddy bear. And so just little things like that, the little stories that went along. The kids could play a little bit. I would put them down for a nap, my youngest down for a nap, and I'd have a nursery monitor, and I could be around the whole cannery working, and as soon as they would wake up, they would come to me and say, Mommy, Annie's up, Annie's awake, and so I would go and get my kids and then take them with me. Mm-hmm. So it was nice to be able to work, but also have my kids with me.
How old were your daughters when you stopped working at the cannery?
My oldest daughter was in sixth grade, and was going into sixth grade, and so my youngest one would have been going into second or third.
Mm.
Yeah.
What were some of the challenges of having your children there?
Keeping them occupied, keeping them happy, because it could be boring. They wanted to run and play, and it's kind of scary to let them do that when you're not actually from there, and there's bears, there's
a lot of hazards there.
There's a lot of hazards. Working with Helvy and Jeannie, Jeannie had a couple sons that the kids adored. And Sarah and Lawrence played together a lot. And Shirley had a daughter about the same age as Sarah, and they played together a lot. And that was my oldest daughter. Annie didn't have, she was younger.
Were there other, aside from the local people that had children, were there other children there as well?
Yeah, but they were older. Bob Deere, when his wife would come up, he had a daughter that was a couple years older than Sarah. So it wasn't always, it was the age difference. Okay. Where it didn't always pan out. So they just learned to work, come along with me.
What were some annual traditions that you had?
Oh, 4th of July, we would get sparklers and walk down to the beach and play with sparklers. That was about it. Every once in a while, the helicopter pilots would bring us pizza from across the river. They made the best pizza ever.
D&D pizza.
What else?
Next time you're in that pick, stop by D&D.
They're really good. It is really good pizza.
Probably still there. Probably still gets the pizza.
needs it.
The helicopter pilot would take us up in the helicopter every once in a while. Actually, two or three times I think we went up. One was because my daughter was playing out in front of the, our daughter was playing out in front of the hotel and stepped down wrong. You know, they have those pipes there, and the tundra's kind of cut away. She stepped down wrong and ended up fracturing her ankle. So he took us across to the clinic. And
Come on.
Come on.
What else?
Get up here.
Did you take part in the ankle volleyball tournament?
One thing I really did like was Helvey took me up. Helvey Anderson took me up one year and taught me how she did her smoked salmon. She was the sweetest lady. Mm. She was a working partner up in the laundry for quite a few years.
She's still there.
She is still there, yes. And just listening to her stories, just being part of her life was wonderful. Mm.
She worked at the cannery for many years, huh?
She did, and she was a set netter, and that woman would eat an onion a day. She's, yes, still does.
A whole onion.
A whole onion, like an apple.
Wow.
Yes,
wow.
Yes, and she's 80-something years old, healthy as can be.
Mm-hmm.
She's, yeah. I remember one year sending her up, and then when I didn't work there any longer, I told the principal of the school I work at back then, bring up, she works in the laundry, bring her, tell your son to bring up some
onions
for her, and you know, so he did.
Nice. Yeah. So what would you do to prepare to leave for the season?
To leave for the season?
To head up to Alaska.
Oh, to go to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
They always sent send everything up on the barge. So basically it was, we would, you know, get stuff we wanted for the kids.
I had a big crate.
He had a great big crate, huge.
It
was always stuffed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big plywood box, basically, about, probably at least 4x4x4. And then usually a few little subcrates too.
Mm-hmm. 1 year, when I worked in the laundry, we sent up a, golf cart.
so that when she was doing laundry, she could tote it. It was an electric golf cart, plug it in every night.
It was great.
Drive
put
about
the kids
and
in.
Car seat in there, and the kids could go.
Because you know,
laundry from place to place.
Yeah, because you'd end up with this huge amount of laundry you'd have to carry from, and it would be impossible with two kids.
But Gary was very accommodating. I bought the golf cart and sent it up there so that, yeah.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah,
it was
great.
Yeah. We used it a lot.
Was that just 1 year that you had it up there?
I think we had it a couple of years. We left it there for a year or two.
In fact, we, underneath the rec hall, our apartment was here, and underneath the rec hall, I had a key where I could just park it under there and plug it in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember if we left it up there in the winter.
I forgot
or
about that.
There.
I don't remember what we did with it. Did we sell it back here, or did... The kids have really fond memories.
They
loved it up there. One year, Sarah got up there and she looked at, she was standing and she goes, "I'm home at last." And she said that in front of Carville Senior, and it just warmed his heart.
We're home
at last. She loved it up there. She loved all the one-on-one she would get talking with the, you know, she was everybody's little girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
A lot of attention.
Were they sad when you stopped going?
I think
she was.
Sarah, I think it was a little bittersweet, you know.
Yeah.
She was ready
they
to stay home.
They were getting older,
and
they were in school.
It was just kind of hard to pack everything up, and when they were little, it wasn't
not easy to take your family up there and back every year.
Oh.
How are they doing?
Is there anything else you want to mention about your time at South Naknek or about the cannery work and
Judy, you have to go outside.
You know, I remember walking through the can shop, because I'd walk, take a nightly walk and stuff. And I remember going, turning the corner, and there'd be a set of stairs. And I remember seeing, like, dates of, and some of them were, you know, written in there, like 18 something something. And I remember seeing it. Did you see that part I'm talking about? Isn't that cool? And just the history behind the cannery was so neat. Yeah, I loved it up there. The first year I coming from Larson Bay to there, I didn't see the beauty of South Naknek, but after being there for so many years, I thought it was a beautiful place, a beautiful area. I loved the locals, especially Helvey and Jeannie. We got really, really close. It was just, you know, it was the friends we made up there. They lasted a lifetime. We still see them. We still talk to them. Yeah. And the sunsets were just gorgeous when you finally got one.